This episode powered by our friends at Strive Labs and the Strive Hub platform, the all-in-one customer relationship management platform built for health and wellness, providing intelligent solutions for clinics and hospitals. Find them online at strivelabs.com.
This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
All right, the next episode of the PT Pintcast starts right now. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. I want to say thanks to everybody that has helped us get to the 100,000 download mark. I blushed a little bit. We're honored, nice. Humbled, and just glad you guys like what we're doing enough to listen and spread the word. So keep up your support and tweet at us at PT Pintcast. Today on the show is the former chief of human performance optimization at the Center for the Intrepid, which is part of the San Antonio Military Medical Center, Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation, for 10 years. There he worked treating service members suffering severe musculoskeletal trauma. His successes include the application of regenerative medicine for volumetric soft tissue loss and return to run clinical pathway, an internationally recognized rehabilitation program designed to combat delayed amputations and complement a dynamic exoskeleton. He's been applying blood flow restriction training clinically since 2012 and credits the modality with significant strength recovery in more than 300 patients. He's been published extensively in the peer-reviewed literature, and his work has been featured on 60 Minutes, Time Magazine, NPR, Discovery Channel, and ESPN. Most recently on Outside the Lines. Went to the University of Texas Medical Branch Galveston for his PT degree and University of Texas at Austin. He's a Longhorn for his undergrad in biology. Welcome to the show, Johnny Owens. Johnny, thanks for taking some time and talking with us, man.
Great to be here, Jimmy. Been excited.
I'm pumped. I've heard you a couple different places. I've been reading about this stuff. It's kind of this cool buzz that's going around the world of PT and strength and conditioning that is the blood flow restriction. And it's cool to hear somebody who's out there talking about it as extensively as you are to get to come on here and just kind of spread the word a little bit. So first question is always the hardest. What are we drinking today?
You know, it's hot as hell down here in Texas. Uh-huh. So, I was going to go with a little darker and a Chimay or an Herval because, you know, it was just such a privilege to be on here. I want to break out the heavy volume alcohol. But my wife loves glassware. And so we had some Hoegaarden. And so she basically told me, you know, if I'm going to pour that out, she got me the actual Hoegaarden glass to put it in. So yeah.
Good.
And depending on how good or bad this goes, you know, then after this, I'm moving on to a Texas beer Alamo.
There you go. I'm a poor PT student still, graduating a couple months. So I just stole some beer from my roommate. Sorry, David. So he got the good stuff though. Apparently New Belgium, the Citradelic Tangerine IPA. There was one beer left in the fridge from last night's Thursday night drinking. And I just stole that from him. So cheers, Johnny. Thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me, man.
So your early work at the San Antonio Military Medical Center. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because to me, that's something really important. That's important work, providing therapy to amputees and some limb salvage patients. What was that like? How'd you get into it?
Actually, it has kind of driven me to where we're, you know, everyone's kind of talking about with this blood flow restriction stuff for sure. And so how I got into it is sports med background. You know, I was an athlete in college, got into PT, thought I was going to stick with that, got into a private practice with some friends, and then it was too much paperwork, not enough clinical time, and I was getting a little frustrated with that. One of our partners in the group used to be the chief of physical therapy at the military base near us, and he told me I might like that environment. Kind of gave me a letter of rec, and I got in as the sports med guy right as the wars were kicking off. Kind of everyone said, well, these conflicts are probably going to be over in a few years. And we really over-prepared for Desert Storm 1. We were going to under-prepare for this one because we don't want to have that same kind of problem. And obviously, you know, now we just wrote a paper for Journal of Trauma, and the actual title of it was What We've Learned After 14 Years of War. And it's amazing that it was really that long. Wow. I always say 11 years, but yeah, when you actually look at the dates. And so that's what happened, man. I came on as a sports med guy and then transitioned to director of limb salvage rehab because we were just getting kind of crushed with amputees, and then even more so with what we call limb salvage, which the loose definition that the past president of the Orthopedic Trauma Association said is anyone who would cut off their limb because it was so badly injured, we categorize as limb salvage. You would understand why they do that. And so for every one amputee, we can't put an exact number on it, but anywhere from, you know, 4 to 6 limb salvage service members would roll into my clinic. And so
what types of stuff were you doing with them? Are you doing, I mean, you're the orthopedic sports guy working with these patients. So your job is strengthen. I mean, am I right in that or what?
Yeah, well, and I'm a real tracking guy, so I would really keep a lot of my data, and you can't really call it data because it wasn't a study, but I, you know, tracking what we were doing early on when I started taking over the limb salvage program. And the problem was these conflicts have had the lowest mortality rate of any modern day conflict. And so if you look at the curve, the fatality rate goes down over time, and we've done a fantastic job, or I haven't, but our medics are awesome. Our medical care back range and downline is fantastic. And when you get these guys and girls home, we're keeping them alive, but because they're living, we're seeing the highest amount of multi-limb injuries and type of polytrauma that you typically wouldn't see in the wartime environment. So we were getting these people that we didn't really know what to do with because a lot of these injuries were just amazing, and stuff you just wouldn't see in the typical world. Not only severely, you know, broken bones with huge gaps that would need Ilazarovs and Taylor spatial frames just to try and see if you can put the bone together, coming in with gigantic missing chunks of muscle. And that's my first foray into moving into kind of what I'm doing now was when a service member comes back, if we fix the bone, but they have a significant amount of muscle that was blown off, is there anything that we can do for that? Medically, there wasn't much we can do other than what we call muscle flaps. So you steal muscle from another part of the body, and basically bone doesn't heal unless you have muscle over it. You know, we used to think it was bone and then it was muscle, but now we're understanding that the bone muscle interface is this new, really interesting world. It's kind of like, you know, it used to be muscle and tendon. Now the muscle tendon junction is very fascinating. It's just a completely new environment. And so, you know, you can steal muscle from another part of the body, but it's not functional muscle. So what we started looking at is, are we getting better with rehab? Nope, we weren't. Okay, is there another alternative? So then we started looking at regenerative medicine potentials. Can we actually regrow muscle in human beings? And then, so that was the kind of first foray when I moved into this regenerative medicine world that led to deeper work with bone and how physical therapists can maybe manipulate bone healing better. And then into, if we can't fix this, can we build an exoskeleton around it to get these guys and girls back to higher level function? And then we ran into the problem that we always were running into is how do you get people stronger with any sort of orthopedic rehab condition? When, you know, the ACSM guidelines are, you need to lift heavy 65, you know, depending on exactly how you read it, 65 to, you know, 90% 1RM over 12 to 16 weeks for novice to intermediate lifters. There's no ACSM guideline that then says, or go do a TheraBand or a little 2 or 3 pound ankle weight. You know, it's right. Just we really hit a brick wall. And part of it is PTs are very well trained in muscle physiology. And the other part is that we're really constrained by the injury and the surgery and whatever.
Necessity is the mother of invention. And unfortunately, the military brings about a lot of medical necessity and you guys being really creative. So yeah. Is that where this blood flow restriction idea came out, which is restricting the blood to hopefully build strength at a lower load?
Yeah. And I always want to clarify, we didn't invent it. The military, I didn't invent it. And when we have a really cool military medical museum. It used to be called Brooke Army Medical Center where we are. It's now San Antonio Military Medical Center. And you can go back and look at the history. You know, there's a lot of debate of who really comes out on the positive side after war. And geopolitically, it's really questionable. One group that always comes out positive, if you look at almost every conflict, is the medical side of the house. And when you look at things that all of a sudden became like, wow, that came out of war, it's typically something that was already out there. But when we're in a war and in these austere environments that create desperate times, you can kind of fast track things. And so, you know, like the IM nail from World War II, intermedullary nail for long bone fractures, Nazi doc was using it on POWs. And it's probably one of the biggest advancements in orthopedic medicine. But if you look back in the records, back in Aztec times, and they've even found long bones, you know, over in Africa that had ivory pushed through them and bone and wood pushed through them. And the Orthopedic Society actually looked at that before the war and kind of abandoned it. Same thing with BFR. It's been out there for a while. It was even in old physiology studies, you know, in the early days as a way to study anaerobic versus aerobic metabolism. But you just never had this mass population that you could apply it to quickly without a lot of the typical constraints that you go through with robust studies.
But that's how you started using it clinically, right, with the right. the amputees. So, and I promise that I passed all the required chemistry classes to get into PT school. I swear, you can look at my my transcripts.
But now, better than me, probably.
Now I'm interested. I just wanted to walk through the chemistry because I'm going to post a link on our website at ptpinecast.com on our blog. I want people to check out this Outside the Lines piece that you had done with Stefania Bell, and it was just really well done. I thought it was laid out very, very nicely for a layman to be able to kind of understand, and then PTs to kind of get a grasp on, because now everybody's talking about it. We've mentioned it's kind of a buzz term, but I talked to Stefania Bell about a week ago and told her I was going to be speaking with you, and she paused and said, this is going to be one of the biggest changes in rehab in the next 5 to 10 years. She's like, mark my words. She's like, I'm pumped to hear what Johnny says. And she'd already been in a piece with you, but she just really emphasized how important she thought it was going to be. So what happens for people who haven't heard about it yet? Explain it like they've never heard. There's a cuff, it's a medical device. Let's start from there, the why. So you're working with a patient that you think needs it. What kind of a patient is that? Where does your head start?
Any patient in rehab that you have a goal to work on strength or hypertrophy. You know, we can really get deep into muscle physiology, but if you just look at the basics of it, you usually have to go through what's called the mechanical tension model, which means you have to lift heavier loads progressively over time to make an adaptive response. And you create damage within the muscle, you create stress within the muscle, and the body allows you to adapt. What you always got to remember, and when you go to my courses, we talk a lot about this, is the body doesn't like to put on muscle. Muscle is very metabolically expensive. And then some people are able to put it on better than others. And there's some things in our body, like enzyme myostatin, which basically keeps your body from putting on muscle. So that's the thing. If a patient comes to you, they're wanting to put on muscle, you have to really put on significant load. We never do that in rehab. So with blood flow restriction training, what we want to do is get into the money fibers, those fast twitch fibers, which are anaerobic. They're in what we call the Cori cycle or the lactic acid cycle. So what we do is we put a specialized tourniquet system on the upper arm or the upper leg, and that's important. Now, and there's a couple things here. For one, tourniquets are medical devices,
right?
And you can't believe the number of emails and things I get. And then I've always said this, if you want to do whatever you want to yourself, go for it. You can wrap a tourniquet around any part of your body, and that's great. As soon as you're in the clinical world and you start occluding blood flow, if something goes wrong, you're in the medical device world, and then you've got some issues. The other thing is you always want to, you know, kind of understand the safety guidelines. You know, I had a team that I worked with, and they were working on a player's lower leg before I got there, kind of messing around with their own stuff, and they were wrapping a tourniquet type device, which was a medical device, around his calf muscle. There's a really important nerve down there. And I would rather have, you know, a high ankle sprain that didn't heal than foot drop. You always keep these tourniquets on the proximal upper thigh or upper arm. We reduce blood flow, and we reduce it by a percentage, and we personalize it to each person. So the amount of pressure to reduce blood flow in your leg, Jimmy, might be 280. It might be, for me, 220. And that's based on how much muscle versus fat you have, the size of your leg, the width of the cuff, the placement of the cuff, your blood pressure. And now a new paper even, you know, are you male or female? Are you black versus white? So we use a Doppler system to be able to figure out the exact amount of pressure to take out. You exercise at a low load. So anywhere between 10 and 30% in one arm, which is basically what we exercise with in the PT world. And as you do that, you basically choke out the Krebs cycle. So oxygen starts to be depleted. You start to build up metabolites within the muscle. You have to switch over to the anaerobic metabolism, and your fast twitch fibers take over. When you've done that, your body measures basically that stress that happened. I mean, it's just signals. So as you're building up all these metabolites, your type 3 and 4 afferents that go to your pituitary gland basically are saying, holy crap, man, we're under like a ton of stress down here. And your body doesn't know if you're in a squat rack lifting 500 for reps, you're running for your life from a dinosaur, or you got a crazy ass tourniquet on your upper leg and you're lifting a 2-pound weight.
It's just measuring a signal. It's measuring a stress response.
Yep.
I'm with you there so far. Good. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like left back in the class. Good. For example, in the piece that you guys are working on with Stefania Bell on ESPN, you guys are working with Dwight Howard. They were focusing on their work with the Houston Rockets. And when they put the cuff on his leg, they were saying it occludes 80% of the blood coming in and 100% of blood coming out.
Right. So we don't know the pressures to say with definitive answers here, yes, this is the pressure that you have to use. Clinically, that's what we were finding was working the best for us. And we track everything. So we were measuring functional changes, strength changes, and tolerance. 80% seemed to work. And also some of the better papers that we were reading that were showing some of the factors that we wanted to see come out. we're using these type of pressures. And now recently, a paper just came out this month that showed if you use 40% occlusion, 60% occlusion, or 80% occlusion, the 80% occlusion, and this was at least in the lower leg, had the highest amount of muscle activation. It was significantly higher from the VMO all the way to the rectus. And so that's just more confirmation. And by using the Doppler, we want some flow going in, and that's for multiple factors too. Having some flow go in, we don't have complete ischemia, so there's still some blood in there. Right. Also, it looks like having some flow go in protects from free radical production, which could actually potentially have some endothelial vascular wall stress and cause hardening. We can't say for sure, but some papers have shown us that. And that's why we choose that pressure. The full occlusion coming back is because it takes less pressure to occlude the veins than it does the arteries. And so just by the nature of that pressure, you're going to fully occlude the return. That has a positive effect, we think, because as we're occluding return, you get like a massive muscle pump. And some people, it's amazing. It looks like their leg is like, it's huge. I mean, it's wild. I have a picture of one of our NBA guys. It looks like his leg's about to blow up. It's just so pumped. But it's fine. And that actually resolves over several hours. But there's some fascinating science out there that by pumping that muscle, you cause the muscle cell to swell. And by causing the muscle cell to swell, you kick in the mTOR pathway. You kick in muscle protein synthesis. Probably one of the most important things rehab professionals need to start understanding is how can we manipulate protein synthesis for our patients?
And the way to do it is you need to apply more load, or in this indication, you need to stress that muscle by occluding it and causing that response. And thus you can get that hypertrophy with less load.
Right, right. And some people are like, well, it's just hypertrophy or whatever. Well, here's the issue with rehab, and it's called anabolic resistance. And this is where the protein synthesis guys have shown us stuff, and then our profession needs to understand it much more, is when you are in a decreased use state in a limb, that protein synthetic response within the limb decreases. Not the rest of the body. Protein synthesis stays at a net neutral balance, but within that limb itself, it goes down. And these studies show in healthies that after a couple of weeks, if they're immobilized or mobilized and non-weight bearing, they've dropped about 30% of protein synthesis within that limb. You know, so then think about almost every kind of thing we see for the lower leg in rehab. And that equals almost 350 grams of muscle tissue that's lost within that limb. And then so you say, I have no idea what that would be. But if you look at what's something equivalent, well, the heart in a human weighs about 300 grams. So over 2 weeks, a downtime with a patient from surgery, from injury, from whatever, they're losing almost more than the size of their heart, primarily in the thigh. Now, we have to find a way to turn protein synthesis on. You got two ways that I can see right now. You can either go lift heavy, which most of them can't, or you can go lift light and you can put a tourniquet on. And we've seen in multiple papers, lifting light with a tourniquet on, you can turn on the mTOR pathway and protein synthesis.
Yeah, everybody wants big muscle, but nobody wants to have to do the heavy lifting. And in the piece on Outside the Lines, it was really explaining that Dwight Howard was using it because Dwight Howard's got big, long legs. He's putting a lot of force through his knees, and he's jumping up and down. So they were using it to make sure he could maintain strength without having to put some more force through his knees, so he can maintain that lower leg strength without having to keep pounding on those knees. So that just kind of highlights another place that this could be applicable, is more performance-based, where you started with the amputees.
Yeah, and you know, man, I think we're like 26 pro and college teams now that I work with. Wow. And the performance side's really taken off. And we had one NBA guy, looked like he had about 2% body fat, and they said he'd lost 16 pounds over the course of a season. You can imagine that that's primarily muscle, because the kid wasn't fat at all.
Right.
And that's what's typical throughout the season. So for one, they are constantly breaking down. And during a hard competitive season, you want to go do the mechanical tension model and break down more muscle? Probably not. So this is a way we can fight the muscle loss. And then also you do have your veteran players or your players who have a bad wheel out there, you know, like some of these guys that are highlighted in these features.
So is there a way that they can change their exercise routine to mimic this so you wouldn't have to use it? Like to not have to cut the blood flow off? Like, is there one type of contraction, like a prolonged concentric contraction, that would mimic this similar to the BFR?
Well, it looks like, you know, what we understand now from physiology is getting a muscle to failure, you're probably doing it a good thing. And so if you do a lower load and you do go to failure, you can probably mimic that. Now, the problem is when you start to compare rep counts, going at a low load to failure, you're getting into potentially, in one study, into the several hundred reps to get to that point. So then you got to wonder, can that much tendon overload and joint overload that's being repaired handle that much prolonged reps?
Right. You'd have a lot of muscle damage. Maybe rhabdo would start to kick in then.
Well, no, not rhabdo. I don't think at that low of a load, but it's just a lot of reps to take. If I have a tendon.
A lot of force.
Yeah. Over time, that many reps over that long of a period, even a lower load, starts to probably take a toll. And in a few studies that have looked at that, those groups that do go to failure at a low load compared to a low load with BFR have more DOMS in the ensuing days.
Gotcha. Now, what are you doing to convince someone? Now, you go and you work with a bunch of proteins. You work with a bunch of pro teams. I'm thinking I got protein on the brain. You work with physical therapists. You do certifications for this, and you can check out more information about Owens Recovery Science. That's owensrecoveryscience.com, or you can follow Johnny on Twitter at Johnny Owens CFI. How are you going in there? How are you convincing a team, a coach, or a team PT or physician, hey, check this out? What's your pitch, or what angle are you going in at?
Wasn't going to sound bad because I don't pitch it at all.
So have they heard about it? They come to you?
Yeah. I don't approach the teams. I don't do any pitching. I mean, maybe some advertising or something like that. Typically, the way it works is, so say in the pros or college, they usually have heard about it from one of the other teams. And so luckily, some early teams kind of came in and asked me, you know, saw what I was doing. A couple years ago, we did a piece with ESPN at the Center for the Intrepid, and that got people excited. I spoke at the NFL Combine. That got a lot of people excited. And so, you know, it's like anything. You know, once you do a couple teams in the SEC, right, all of a sudden every team in the, you know. And so either they want to do it because they've talked to someone else and they've told them, you know, it seems like it's been really powerful. Or they might be like, holy crap, you know, this star player of ours has an injury that we're very concerned about, and I'll go out there and work with them for that. So, yeah, and I'm not trying to skate around your question. Usually what happens here is you, if you talk to someone, like say, you know, I just am talking to an orthopedic surgeon or someone at a conference, and you first tell them about it, they look at you like you're on crack. And they're just like, you're full of it, you know. But then when you kind of get down into the science a little bit, and just explain this fast twitch versus slow twitch, and everyone, you know, medical should at least have a basic understanding of aerobic versus anaerobic metabolism, then all of a sudden they're like, well, okay, this is starting to make a little bit of sense. And then the next thing you know, we're talking about how to manipulate satellite cell migration to increase myocyte content. So that's usually the way it goes. There are definitely people that are very nervous and concerned about doing it, and that's completely fine. And I think those people are the ones who will need to wait and see how it goes.
Right. The good thing is, you stressed this before, you've stressed it on other podcasts, you stressed it on your website, is that this is a medical device and should be done under controlled and supervised conditions. So I think the more people do it that way, the longer this will stick around and the safer it will eventually be when it reaches more people.
Well, that's the thing. You know, our profession is so bad at jumping on fads. And that's what makes me very nervous with this. And I've been working with the folks at APTA. I mean, they've already done the Practice Act review and looked at 10 states and said that this looks like it falls perfectly within our Practice Act. And you know, we got to just do things the right way.
Right.
And, you know, standardize something for once in our life in this profession would be beautiful, where we're all kind of doing the same thing that we can track and that we are bringing something to the table. We very rarely have something, I feel, where there's a strong scientific-based medicine to it. So we have all these high-end academic labs. I mean, I had 3 research calls yesterday, and you know, these labs are amazing at what they're measuring in animal models, in biopsy models, that they want to look at this deeper, from protein synthesis to satellite cell migration. That's awesome. So we have people that are justifying, like, yes, something that we're doing makes a lot of scientific sense. And then now we have an explosion of clinical trials that have come out of this. I mean, like, myself, I have $6 million in funds in prospective trials, you know, with centers like Hopkins and the military and shock trauma and Vanderbilt all over the country. That's very, very powerful. And when we bring those two things to the table to an insurance payer, it's undeniable. If it all goes the right way, then all of a sudden, you know, we're in a different world. There's not a lot of science-based medicine to a lot of these other things that we do. There's no lab, and then I'm not bashing it, but there's no scientific lab out there that wants to know more about scraping or any of that stuff with our tools. And that's just because there's just not a great rationale. And so when you don't have that, it's very hard to go say, hey, I want a $4 million multi-center trial for this. But that's what we have to have. And that's what we're getting with this.
That's cool. All right. We're going to take a quick break with Johnny Owens. When we come back, we've talked about where we were and where we are. I want to know where we're going to go and what's coming up and where this will lead to. Back in 60 seconds in the PT Pinecast. Don't move.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it. Yeah. This is the PT Pinecast.
This episode powered by our friends at Strive Labs and the Strive Hub platform, the all-in-one customer relationship management platform built for health and wellness, providing intelligent solutions for clinics and hospitals using their patient portal, automation tools, and content management system to design custom care management workflows that drive improved patient outcomes, automate outreach, boost engagement, find loyal customers, and close the loop to manage customer retention, identify trends, and make changes that will grow your clinic. Find them online at strivelabs.com. That's strivelabs.com.
Working out his orbicularis oris until failure. Jimmy McKay on the PT Pinecast.
And we're back on the PT Pinecast with Johnny Owens talking blood flow restriction training. You can check out more information about Johnny at owensrecoveryscience.com if you wanted to look into a certification. You can also follow him on Twitter at Johnny Owens CFI. Johnny, we talked about where we were with blood flow restriction. Would you ever see you using blood flow restriction on Bevo? I had the mascot drop. I mean, you're a long
one. No, man. No, because you want your cows nice and fat. So it's like the Belgian blue. You seen that cow that's myostatin deficient? Yeah, right? I don't want my cow to be like that.
All jacked up.
Freaks me out.
So you wouldn't do that because you want it to taste, you want it to be marbled. You want it to taste good.
Although you'd never eat Bevo, but still.
You can't, no.
Yeah.
All right, so we talked about where blood flow restriction training was. You kind of walked us through who you'd use it on in terms of a type of patient. Do you have to use this multiple times to see benefits, like if you do this 2 to 3 times? And then what are you doing afterwards? Are you just doing a situation with the blood flow restriction training? Are you complementing this with something else afterwards too?
Question number one, yes, you should do it multiple times. It's another form of strength training, and so one or two sessions isn't going to make a change, although you'll definitely probably feel it. You do need to do it progressively over time. What you do afterwards? So, you know, that's a question we get lots of times. So is this just all you do? Is it just blood flow restriction or what else should you do? When you strength train really heavy, you're going to be very fatigued afterwards, right? And so there's indirect markers of muscle damage and there's direct markers of muscle damage. An indirect marker of muscle damage, for instance, would be something like MVC. So how much strength you have after you do something. After you lift heavy, your MVC has gone down significantly. And it typically will stay down over several days because there's muscle damage, and that's just the way the mechanical tension model works. It's another reason why in performance, a pro athlete has to question should they lift heavy in a performance in an enduring season. When you do BFR, you are very weak afterwards as well. If it's on your arm or leg or whatever, you're going to feel a very, very jelly leg or jelly arm. That is not a time to go do a high performance type thing. You don't want to do your agility work. You don't want to do your box jumps. You don't want to do any you know, O-lifts or something like that. But what you've done is you've taken your patient or your athlete or whatever to fatigue. That's a great time for us to start working on our movement patterns. That's a great time for us to start working on balance, all your proprioceptive work and things like that to see how they can control something, because we know injuries happen typically at the end of the game or when people are fatigued. So that's the way we do it. We'll do our manual stuff first, you know, your range, all that sort of stuff. And then every exercise, we ask people, why are you doing this? And if you say, I'm doing this for strength and hypertrophy, then we say, well, what are you doing? Are you lifting heavy enough loads to make a change? If they say, I don't think so, or I don't know, then we say, it's a light load. Do you think that's going to make a change? What's interesting in the BFR literature, most of the studies run like this. You do an exercise at a low load, 20-30% rep max, or you do it with the BFR on. What's really, really depressing is all those exercises at light load. When you look at the things that matter, did you turn on protein synthesis? Did you increase IGF? Did you increase growth hormone? Did you make any of these changes that matter? Did you change strength and hypertrophy? It's almost always no. That's bad. That's like, damn, we should reimburse all of our patients over these years, because, you know, and not only that, we send them home and say, keep doing this all night when you're beat down with your family and you know, keep making no change. So then we say, okay, if it's for strength and hypertrophy, you're not lifting heavy. From what we can see from quite a amount of literature, I would probably go ahead and occlude blood flow to see if I can get into this anaerobic metabolism to get a systemic response or to cause the cell swelling. We don't know exactly which one matters more, but you will get an effect from what we've seen in the literature.
We saw Dwight Howard on the recumbent bike. Are there any different exercises that you prefer to do in terms of targeting specific muscles? Because even a strong guy, I mean, calls himself Superman, Dwight Howard, was looking a little fatigued after working on the recumbent bike while he was getting some blood flow restriction.
And that wasn't a recumbent bike. That was actually, I think it's called the Accentron. Eccentric loading machine. So the poor guy, they put him on like a really hard machine. It looks like nothing to most people.
Right.
But he did it at a low intensity. Any rehab exercise is fair game. Your mat exercises, moving on up to body weight stuff, moving on up to getting into the gym and then doing some pressing either for the legs or the arms, or your rotator cuff exercises. You know, we have a wrist fracture study, your gripping exercises, your wrist exercises. Everything is fair game if it has a purpose of strength and hypertrophy.
Okay.
Now, there's other things we're looking at, you know, for working with tendinopathies. We have a study looking at that. We've been having some really good clinical success. Those things we're looking at differently with bone as well. There's three mechanisms that we're trying to target potentially for bone healing. And so we'll address those differently. But if we're just talking about the basics of strength and hypertrophy, that's where we are.
Gotcha. So how do you see this changing how we train people as we go forward? As I mentioned earlier, Stefania Bell paused when I was on the phone with her. And so this is going to be one of the biggest changes of the next 5 to 10 years. Where do you see this going in the future?
I think the writing's pretty much been on the wall. The way that just the general growth has happened, and the way it's getting out there, I think it's going to be something that's part of curricula in schools. I've done courses at I think 3 PT schools now, and they're as well as a couple ATC schools. It's going to be basically part of rehab, and I think and I hope it's a part of rehab that has a lot of legs to it scientifically as well as clinically, and it becomes something very powerful for our profession that we can go to payers and say, look, this is what we need. You know, part of what's positive is the orthopedic community has embraced this. We call the mavens, the ones who kind of are the ones who drive the real opinions out there. From what they've seen, they are the ones who are really pushing this out there as well. And so I think we're going to have friends in our orthopedic side of the house that are going to want to see this done. And we see this. You know, I just had a group today said their doctor said he wants BFR done. They didn't have anyone who knew how to do it, didn't have a unit, no one's been certified. And they were like, man, we need to hurry up and get this because our ortho surgeon wants this done. At our site, we have almost more patients now that are inquiring about it than we do clinicians.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the buzz gets out there when someone finds out, especially if they're an athlete, because we always want to do things bigger, stronger, and definitely faster. People find out about stuff.
Yeah.
Especially the athletes.
Yeah.
So you can go ahead and plug it. I mean, you do certifications where people can come to you and you can go to them on your website, owensrecoveryscience.com. And what does one of those units cost, ballpark?
They are $4,900 ballpark. The unit isn't mine, and I don't have a patent on it. It's a company called Delphi in Canada. They're one of the biggest tourniquet researchers and manufacturers there is. I think they have like 200 whatever 50 something tourniquet patents. It's their unit. That's their price point. But there's a lot of technology into this. And luckily, they were already working on something like this for some other applications whenever I met with them. But yeah, it has the Doppler technology in it, the unit, the cuffs, which are all medical device listed with
the FDA. So it's kind of an all-in-one unit specifically for this.
Yep, that's it, yeah. Because we know that's a higher price point for PTs, for sure. I mean, these pro teams break out their credit card.
Right.
It's even on workers' comp now in the pros. But there is a lease-to-own and a rent-to-own option that we were able to get a finance company to do.
Check out more info, owensrecoveryscience.com. I'll just let you know, I was at a job interview. I graduated from PT school in a couple months and recently on a job interview. Thank you. And I'm in the middle of the interview, and it was two people from the clinic talking to me. Interview's going well, and they brought up blood flow restriction. What do you know about that and dry needling? And the cool part was I knew from doing research for you coming on the show, I knew more than the person interviewing me. So she was pretty interested in my knowledge in this. So you helped me out with that. So check him out on Twitter as well and follow for some good information about this topic and others at Johnny Owens CFI. Each episode is a pint, and before we're done with the pints, we do shots, parting shots of wisdom. So what do you have in terms of wisdom nuggets that you can drop on us in terms of blood flow restriction or anything?
Man, I wasn't ready for this. So
we surprise you with the shots.
Yeah.
That's what happens with shots. Someone turns around, they got a tray of shots. They're always a surprise.
You know, one thing, I think you're a new grad coming out, and I really think those first few years are so influential and kind of paving the way you're going to go. And then people make these decisions when they come out, you know, am I going to do this fellowship? Am I going to take this job or whatever? And those first few years, really think about every step you take. And I think it really changes a lot. And what I did early on has just set me up. And I've been very, very picky. I always say I follow this hell yeah rule. And if something I do doesn't make me say hell yeah, I don't do it. And I've had one of the coolest PT professions out there, or careers, I mean, professions. I think that's something that people should really think about as they come out. When I first got out of school, I had a chance to take two jobs. One paid a lot more than the other. And I asked them both if I could work part-time at both of them to figure it out. And thank God I did. You know, I was at the one that paid a lot more, and it was miserable. And I could tell. The other job, it was awesome. And I always said, man, if I could get that job back, I would go back there once I'm ready to retire just to go have fun. And then that kind of set me up. So, I mean, it's always say don't go for the money type thing. But choose your path wisely.
I like that. You said two things in that parting shot that I like. One, you mentioned at the very beginning of the show that you were in a situation and doing a lot of paperwork and not a lot of clinical time. And then you change gears. You said, hey, I'm happier doing this, so I'm going to go do this, whether it be more money or less money, but you're going to be happier. And the second is the hell yeah rule. I am totally going to steal that, man. I mean, my rule for this podcast has been similar to that. I got to have fun and learn something. But I think that's what hell yeah means. If that's what you're into, especially if you're a PT. So I like that a lot. I'm going to tweet the hell out of that. The hell yeah rule.
Yeah, there's a lot of burnout in our profession, so we got to find ways to keep people motivated, man.
That's cool. Well, hey, I expect this thing to keep just growing and growing. Again, we're going to put up some of the links online at ptpinecast.com. People can check out the videos and stuff's going on there. Again, you can check out more information with Johnny at owensrecoveryscience.com or on Twitter at johnnyowenscfi. And it's been a pleasure, man. I like talking about this stuff because it really is. It is cutting edge, and it's very new for our profession. I hope some people do grab onto it. Buzz is catching. I think it's coming around.
Definitely. I agree, man, 100%.
Cool. Well, hey, enjoyed having a beer with you, and hope this isn't the last time we talk.
Hey, man, take care, Jimmy.
Taking IPAs over TKAs. It's the PT Pinecast.
Just talked to this guy a couple weeks ago, and he was a few thousand miles from where he is right now. A native Kiwi from New Zealand, pedaling across the United States in the name of the Foundation for Physical Therapy. Dr. Stanley Paris calling in from the road. Dr. Paris, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be where I am now.
I bet you are. You've earned wherever you are right now because you've gone a few thousand miles since California. When we talked just before, you were about to set off on your trek, averaging over 100 miles a day on the bike and all to raise some money for the Foundation for Physical Therapy. We just had Dr. Michael Miller on just a couple days ago. He was just kind of in awe how far you were going to go. I'm a triathlete. I ride a lot, and I'm still in awe of how far you have gone. And you're close to the finish line, right? I think I was checking up on your blog, and you're now in the state of Florida.
Yes, we just crossed the state of Florida yesterday and came into Pensacola, and this is our third day of rest. So with 30 days on the bike and 3 days rest, and the third day is here at Pensacola. And
wow.
4 more days, and we're going to be in St. Augustine.
So in between where you are and where you kicked off in California, what'd you see? What have you seen? I mean, that's got to be some great views just pedaling across the United States.
Well, you see an awful lot of asphalt. You're looking. You see nuts and bolts, and you see glass, and you see bits of tire tread, everything from shrapnel to artifacts of the First and Second World War. It all seems to be on the road in front of you. And you can't take your eye off the road for very long. You hit something.
Yeah.
About.
What's the count on flat tires?
So 5 and 5. We both had 5 flat tires.
That's not that bad for 3,000 miles.
Not that bad. It's like one every 3 days.
That's not bad. All right.
But if you live in perpetual fervor, because you know it's going to happen, it's just a matter of when. And then it's usually, an unfortunate place, and you've got to do the damn tire yourself. It takes quite a few minutes to do that, and get up and get going again.
All right. Well, how about roadkill? I'm assuming you've seen your awful fair share of roadkill as well. Whenever I'm on the bike, there's always something laying in the road that has just recently expired.
Yes, everything from caterpillars up to turtles, two dogs, lots of roadkill. So you have to watch for that. I think I've killed about 2 snakes and about 12 caterpillars.
So some animals were harmed accidentally during the ride for PT research, benefiting the Foundation for Physical Therapy.
Right. I'm very sorry about that, but that just happens, yes.
So all of this in the name for the foundation. You can check out more information at foundation4pt.org. You can find out some more information about the ride with Dr. Paris at his website, which is Stanley PetersonParis.com. You set off on April 1st, and the goal was stay above 100 miles a day, 3,000 miles in 30 days, and as you said earlier, just 3 days of rest. How are you feeling physically?
Well, you know, that's the incredible thing.
Right.
I was concerned that I wouldn't build strength, that I'd actually lose strength. On the contrary, I think it's got easier each day. The last few days, it was 102 miles, 107, 106, 107, 110. It seems to be getting easier. My legs look fantastic. I have 78 years of age. I haven't seen looking like this in 35 years.
Wow. Good for you. What were some highlights? How about some locations, some places you haven't been before that you got a chance to stop at and hang out? And it's different when you see it from the back of a bicycle.
It is. It is. Some of the stops along the way, some of the smaller towns, because you see them in detail. You're not flying through at 70 miles an hour. You stop and take a look, take pictures, of course. It's a lot of, what I noticed, surprisingly, is the number of businesses that have failed. Some in recent years, but it looks like so many people are leaving the country, and they leave behind a store, a business, something, and it just lies there vacant, and there's no chance of selling it or anything like that. We are gradually moving more and more to the cities, and the farms are getting bigger, and so small country towns are sort of fading away, unfortunately.
I've been catching up on your blog and just taking a look at some of the pictures that you guys had posted. It's good to see some people joining you on the ride and donating some money to ride along with you. That's got to be exciting, meeting some new people along the way.
Yes, there hasn't been a great deal of it. Of course, it's very difficult for people to do that, taking days off during the week and do 100 miles a day or thereabouts. But we've had some very fine people join us. And then on the other hand, we've met a few other cyclists along the way. Not many, probably not more than five or six on the whole trip. But they've got good stories, and some of them are doing it by themselves and they're loaded up with all their gear, whereas the two of us are being rather spoiled because we have two SAG vessels carrying our gear and stopping every 10, 20 miles and getting us refreshments. So we've been spoiled, but it's been wonderful. My wife, Catherine, has been driving one vehicle, and my son, Stan, the other. And it's been great to have them along.
Yeah, just seeing a familiar face and knowing somebody's out there makes being on the bike a little bit more bearable. So I saw you talk briefly about Charles Magistro passing away while you were on your ride, and you giving a great deal of thanks to him. And I just wanted you to talk briefly about how he inspired you to do some of the things you've done for the foundation, and hopefully can inspire some other people to do the same.
Well, Charles was a unique individual. He and his wife, Noelle, two fine, fine people. Charles was one of the founders of the private practice section, and he became president of the American Physical Therapy Association. But he also had a hand in starting the foundation and stayed with it through some very difficult financial years at its inception. And he spent a lot of his own personal money funding it. And he lived, fortunately, to see the last few years where the effort of the foundation to spearhead research in physical therapy in this day of evidence and practice, evidence-based training and all of that, to see it come to fruition, and at the same time to know that many of the researchers that the foundation has trained have produced a great deal of good work that's advancing our profession. And he must have felt very good about that, and I sincerely hope he did, because enough people thanked him in the last few years. And he was a steady person at the conferences. A lot of people, when they sort of retire, they go away, but not him. He was there every year and always there to help people with advice and always had good things to say, and was a most helpful figure in physical therapy, a great leader. He'll be sorely missed, but his time on this planet was well spent. Yeah. For physical therapy.
Well, I'm sure he'd be honored to know you're speaking so highly of him during this ride and doing it to hopefully inspire others to do the same as he did to you. So let's get back to the reason. Again, I just talked to Dr. Miller about the Foundation for Physical Therapy, and he talked a little bit about some of the research that that he wanted to highlight in terms of receiving some of the grants. And that's got to feel good to know that while you're out there pedaling, it's for a cause.
That makes me feel good, of course. But it's not always the money you raise. It's the awareness you raise. I think 5-10 years ago, not many people knew about the foundation.
Right.
And knew that it was the best place to spend precious research dollars. And I think now people do understand that the foundation has the means to not only receive funds from physical therapists and from corporations, but to multiply those funds when they put together a project with a good research team. We can usually raise additional money from NIH and other sources. So it's well spent money when you give to a foundation, and the foundation has a lot what I can now show you is proof of how well they've done in advancing the scientific basis of our profession. I'm very happy to be a trustee. I'll be leaving the board soon. I don't know how many more months, but I'll be very sorry to leave it, because it's been an enjoyable experience helping to work with the foundation to raise funds. And my part has been raising a lot of awareness of the foundation.
Absolutely. I think you're doing a pretty good job. You're really putting your gluteus maximus where your mouth is and saying, look, I'm willing to put up with 3,000 miles if you just pay attention to this one thing, which is the Foundation for Physical Therapy. You can find out some more information about the ride and the foundation at Dr. Parris's website, as I said, stanleyparris.com. And the donations can come in there as well. You've got a link at stanleyparris.com or online at foundation4pt.org. So the big question is, you got a couple days left. You're already in Florida. Florida is no small state, though. When you finish, what's the first thing you're going to eat, and what's the first thing you're going to do?
You mentioned my gluteus maximus. Well, it's bruised, blistered, pretty sore shape. First thing I'm going to do, I'm going to walk down to the ocean, and I'm going to dip the front wheel of the bike into the Atlantic Ocean. We dipped our back wheels into the Pacific Ocean, and we're going to dip our front wheels into the Atlantic Ocean, having crossed the country. And then I think I'm just going to dive into my swimming pool and play with my dog.
Good. Well, you've earned some well time with your feet up in the air, sir. So if you'd like to make sure that Dr. Parris's ride is fruitful, you can make a donation. No donation too small. Check out online at stanleyparris.com, and that money going for the Foundation for Physical Therapy. If you want to hear more about exactly what the Foundation for Physical Therapy can do and does with the money, how it figures out how to disperse that money, we had a previous episode with Dr. Michael Miller, episode 71, and you can take a listen to that. Dr. Parris, wish you all the best. Hope the wind stays behind you as you wrap up your last 5 days.
Thank you, James. And the second thing I'll be doing will be having a nice IPA.
Make sure you get yourself a beer. Absolutely. Put your feet up and have yourself a beer, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Like what you hear? Leave us a review on iTunes. It's not like our moms can keep giving us 5 stars every day. Or can they? The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.